Episodes 6 and 7 of Wayward Pines may have wrapped up, but we are just getting started here on post-show recaps, the bi-weekly edition of our Wayward Pines coverage, where we drag out everything from the 2,000-year-old dustbin and see, you know, what's going on in this idyllic little Utah town. I am Kurt Clark here with you, as always, and joining me, as always, also the wonderful AJ Mass. AJ, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Kurt. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I guess I'm one of those people that has acclimated to the fact that we are now 2,000 years in the future.
Yeah, and I think I'm about ready to join the conspiracy and get myself out of Wayward Pines once and for all.
Well, we are in the home stretch. There are, what, 3 more episodes? Unless it gets that renewal pickup.
Fingers crossed!
Oh, boy. This was an interesting, like, if episode 5, which we covered with Mike Bloom a couple weeks back, if that was kind of the reveal, I guess then episode 6 was kind of the exposition part 2, and episode 7 was the prestige, was the escalation. I don't know, it was, lots of exposition and random stuff, but Let's I guess just jump right in.
Sure.
Boy. Episode 6, I had to go back, obviously, you know, covering this every other week, had to go back and review. It did have that kind of that confusing opening, the cold open of, yeah, this main drag of Wayward Pines, where everything is destroyed, and you see, at first what I thought was Ethan, but it turns out it's Dr. Pilcher, just kind of like walking down the street. And I had no idea, like, what this was supposed to be. Like, is this a flash forward, a flashback? We got into lots of flashbacks in this episode.
Yeah, it's that nice little thing where you can start off with that moment of, you know, we ended episode 5. It was like, okay, there's a lot to take in, and they're not going to make it easy on us and spoon feed us in episode 6. They jump right in with a, when are we? Which is kind of, I guess, putting us in the position of the townspeople, sort of, or at least Ethan's mind. Like, when are we? Really? It gives us that sense of uncertainty, I guess, is what they were trying to do there.
Yeah, and I was bouncing back and forth between, like, is this a dream? Is this the catastrophe that kind of triggered everything from downhill? But obviously we find out later what's going on. But then they do the old kind of cut to the main drag again, but now everything looks nice. And you have this little girl watching the copter with Ethan and the doctor and Pam heading to the complex, the mountainside bunker, where we do get that finally get that look behind the scenes of what is going on in Wayward Pines. I kind of refer to my notes as the exposition bunker, because that's really all that happens.
Yeah, this is kind of where the writers can play a little bit with filling in. If there's a loophole that they think they found in the script, they can explain it away here. They can pretty much explain any of the questions that you had dangling out there. This is the chance, the open forum, like, okay, we know you had this question. Here's the answer. We know you had this question. Hey, who was on the other end of the phone when he called his office? Oh, well, it was this woman over here. And then, oh, you know, hey, how did they get the bread? Oh, well, here's where the deliveries come from. So it was kind of like a, all right, we were playing by the rules, and here's you know, opening up all the doors and saying, here it is. Here's what was going on in the past.
For those of you who want to go back and watch the first 5 episodes, this should make everything clear.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like part of my reluctance to fully embrace this show now that we're at episode 7 is kind of the fact that this really feels, because of the limited scope of this series, it really feels that those first 5 episodes were a season 1, which should have taken 13 episodes. And this is kind of like the, okay, we've caught our breath. This is the season 2 opener. We're going to start slow and kind of like, oh, fill in, like, hey, you know that big cliffhanger we left you with all summer? Well, yeah, here's kind of where we're going from here, and here's, you know, all that. And I don't know that in such a limited series I'm taking to it as much as perhaps I would if I had 13 episodes and like, whoa, that's a great, you know, the timing of this, the pacing of the show is really off for me. And slowing it down now at episode 6 to kind of provide all this exposition, oh, man, what a drag.
I agree completely. I think maybe going back to how I kind of said it, well, this is kind of like exposition all over again. Like, you almost left episode 5 with the big reveal. That was like a season, like you said, like a season end cliffhanger. And then now we're kicking off season 2 of Wayward Pines, a 5-episode season, where this did feel like a premiere where they didn't necessarily feel like they had momentum that they had to maintain. But they did. They had momentum they needed to maintain, and they didn't.
Right. It almost feels like the pilot of the show.
Yeah.
Like, if the show had started here, like, hello, Ethan, you have woken up from cryo slumber, and this is the new world, but you can't tell anyone. That could have been episode 1. And I think I might have been like, okay, cool. That's an intro to the world. I get that the twist in the middle is what's kind of, hooking a lot of people. Like, you know, where's the twist? What's going on? Execution here, I think they kind of were like, hey, that was a really great reveal. Where do we go from here? And I don't know. I don't know if I really think they had an answer.
Because we kind of, in the last episode, in episode 5, we saw a lot of things being explained to Ben. I wonder if this could have been handled, if the reveal to Ben, if the reveal to Ethan could have been handled in parallel to the reveal to Ben. So all of this exposition, all this explaining and revealing and peeks behind the scenes, maybe get handled in the same episode. I don't know, but we get the call center of 200 volunteers.
Yeah, and it's you know. Again, they're also serving two different things here. They're providing the, hey, in the here and now, Ethan, here's what happened. And we're going to do the flashback motif now, in the midst of all this exposition, to kind of say, oh, and here's how I started remember back when I was just a crazy professor whose ideas were laughed at by everybody.
And I, there was the upside for me, though, is we got to see, I think, at least an interesting side of Pam, of Nurse Pam, in episode 6. Like, the moment they get into the exposition bunker, she's smiling, she's downright pleasant. It's a completely different Pam from what we've seen in the past, which was interesting to see, at the very least.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of, through the course of this episode, I don't even know if we need to go scene by scene in this one, because it's just, I mean, it's a lot of it is just like catching us up. And it can be summed up in the sense that, yeah, he's nuts, but he lacks confidence. She's nuts. And we learn that they're actually brother and sister, or at least that's what they're telling us. I mean, you know, who knows anymore if I trust them, even in a flashback. But we learn they're brother and sister, and that she's, you know, a recovering drug addict, and, you know, but she fully supports him in all his crazy ideas, which end up, as it turns out, not to be crazy, that the Abbeys do exist, and, you know, if they hadn't gone into this cryogenic slumber, there'd be no people left.
Yeah, it's that we can. Yeah, that's definitely. I think we can, you know, move things along by kind of covering all of this bunker action at in one fell swoop. And it's interesting because, yeah, his predictions about what was happening to the world in terms of, you know, the world, you know, we're having an impact on the world and the world is changing around us, but at the same time, that impact we're having on the world is also kind of changing us ourselves. And we need to almost remove ourselves from the timeline for 2,000 years for everything to be ready for us to come back. I mean, he's right about that. But, you know, hiring the security guard to be his kidnapper of key people, maybe he's not quite spot on with some of those decisions in terms of how he reacts to the correct news that he's predicted.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it almost seems like this episode is here to establish that Pilcher, although he was right,
yes,
was right almost by accident. He just happened to have the one crackpot idea that turned out to actually come to fruition. So the fact that he was able to somehow, you know, divert funds from his company to create the cryogenic chamber and freeze everybody, you know, the fact that he was able to get Sheriff Pope to, you know, Security Guard Pope to kind of like, you know, climb on board and become his main heavy of kidnapping people in order to freeze them against their will. You know, the fact that everything in the end turns out to be right. You know, he survives. Yeah. The people that he has saved, he has saved. He is the hero. But it also establishes that he's a complete inept moron in many other ways. And just the fact that, you know, he... You know, to me, it was like he's telling Ethan all of this. Now, Ethan has just been informed of this huge reality, and he's tried to escape from Wayward Pines. He's violent. He doesn't trust them. You can tell he doesn't trust them. And what do? You know, they kind of just say, "Hey, you stay here, and we'll be back later. See ya." And they let him wander around the place. And it's just like, no wonder, you know, the Wayward Pines is falling apart.
Apparently the rules only exist in the town and not in the bunker.
Oh my goodness. Just let the one guy who can screw up your entire plans, the one dangerous guy you've brought in here, let him wander around. And maybe he'll accidentally release an Abby.
Yeah. Okay, I hear this strange screeching sound that that I recall from the woods. I'm going to go investigate that. In the darkest rooms in the complex. It was definitely strange. And he, by the end of it, by the end of it, though, he's completely, you know, based on what he, you know, he saw burned out Salt Lake City.
Boise.
Utah. He's in Idaho. Right?
I know. Yeah. It's fine. You know, Beehive State, you know, Boise, whatever.
He saw Boise. Because, yeah, I was saying Salt Lake City. You know, that sounds way too long of a name for what it actually was. He's completely buying what the doctor has told him. Like, he completely, at least it seems, believes that this is 4028. But he's also very adamant that, okay, you know, while you may be right, sir, your approaches for how you've handled things are completely inept and wrong, and you shouldn't be killing people, and you know people can't continue to live in fear. But we do kind of get the explanation around that opening scene that we saw. You know, like, you know, while Ethan's kind of making the case for, well, you should just tell everybody and people will be okay with that. Turns out that opening scene we saw was kind of the plan A, and they're now at plan B or take two on Wayward Pines, where, you know, everybody, you know, killed themselves or went crazy or tried to escape. And things did not go well, apparently, when you told people the truth, as if we're meant to assume that this is an accurate telling of the facts.
Yeah, I mean, the first time around, Dr. Pilcher kind of like wakes people up and tells them what's going on and clues them in. And like he said, half the town goes nuts and half the town just opts out. And, you know, he's such a bad scientist that he takes this as, you know, well, if it happened this way this one time, it'll happen this way all the time. So, I get his impulse to say, all right, let's try it a second time to see if maybe we can change the result by not telling people. But clearly that's not working either. And the fact that he's been so willing to just say, all right, well, you know what, I'm going to see this experiment through to the end as well, and I still got people, you know, sleeping here, so I can always boot up reboot 3 when this doesn't work. I mean, again, he's a crackpot, and he's running the place like a crackpot, and I wouldn't trust him either if I was Ethan, and so, you know, I would probably say whatever he wanted me to say just so I could get out, and then, you know, move, you know, I'll tell people when I get out if I want, just whatever, dude.
Yeah, it's, he's kind of like, if he's a master, if Dr. Pilcher's kind of an expert in the hard sciences, but, you know, breaking this news to people is more of a soft science. And so I'd like to see this communications plan and how he actually broke the news to people. And I'm sure there's something there that could have been tweaked and adjusted to make it more bearable as people came into this new reality. I think don't completely give up on the fact that people will accept this. And, you know, we're meant to believe that, but the high schoolers, they're the ones that have the mental wherewithal to actually accept this new reality and process it fully.
Yeah, because, you know, high school traditionally the place of indoctrination. So if we indoctrinate them from the get go with the truth, it's easier for them to accept. They're more malleable. They're not as set in their ways. They don't have to they're not going to worry about, my IRA and my my favorite sports team. Like, you know, they're kids. They'll rebound a lot quicker if we tell them the truth now.
But we do see. I mean. We, in the flashback scenes, we see security guard Polk becomes, you know, it's drawn in. And we also do see Megan, who eventually is Megan Fisher, is completely on board the Pilcher train. And so I'm wondering to what extent her hypnotherapy is an integral part of the acceptance of the students to this new reality. Like, if she wasn't there to, you know, work her mojo, would the students be less malleable or less acceptable? I think we're meant to assume that.
Yeah, I think we're meant to see her as the kind of person who is so enamored by a cult leader of sorts. I mean, Dr. Pilcher, in essence, is portrayed as almost a cult leader. He's written this book, and people are coming to him, and most of the mainstream science is saying, you're a fool, you're insane, you're crazy. But, you know, the people who really are in his inner circle and really believe, they support him, and they're all in. So to have that kind of person in charge of indoctrinating the next generation, or the first generation, into this is the way, and this is the truth, and the great Dr. Pilcher, whom you will never meet, he is the great one. You know, it's like, it's almost like the great David Koresh, who lives. Yeah. The comet is coming. Everyone, put on your sneakers, quick, lie down. It's that kind of cult feel. And like I said, I do like the fact that I just wish it was hammered home a little more that, like, this was a cult. They just happened to get it right through sheer luck. And I think that's kind of an intriguing thing to see play out. I just don't necessarily think that that's the story they're trying to tell. And I wish they would have steered into the skid a little bit more with this one.
you do get a little bit of it in the closing scenes of episode 6 in the bunker where, shortly after we learn that Group A was told the truth and that this is now Group B, you know, Pilcher kind of goes on this thing, these are the dark ages and enlightenment is coming. And, you know, this new generation, they will spread the seed because they are young minds. You start to get kind of that cult feel there, but you're right. It's just kind of, it's very focused at that one point, and it doesn't necessarily seem intentional. But it's also kind of in those closing scenes where it really tees up some of the main conflict that's going to happen in episode 7, which is that there's, you know, Pilcher acknowledges, you know, there's a lot here that disgusts you, but we do have to work together to protect the town because there is a new threat. There is a faction that wants to take down the fence, and we can't let them succeed. And we saw, you know, so that's the fact that Pilcher knows this is one thing, and we kind of see the seeds of this being built up in parallel by what the actual scenes that are taking place in the town.
Yeah, well, here's my question for you on this. Okay, Pilcher tells Ethan, hey, there's this element in the town that's planning to blow up the wall, blow up the fence, which will let the Abbeys in and will destroy our town. How does he know this? Because if he knows this through surveillance, doesn't he know who's involved?
It's kind of like a binary thing where you can't just know a little bit about this. Like, the moment you know some of it, you probably know at least 5 key people who are involved.
Yeah, it seems to me that it seems that I cannot believe that this show is going to play out as this suddenly becomes Homeland, where they're just trying to catch the terrorist cell before it strikes. I mean,
they could be anywhere.
Yeah, it just strikes. The show did not turn on a dime to become that. And if it has, then they failed miserably. I mean, yeah. Doesn't there have to be, like, we'll get into this a little bit in episode 7, I think, is like, doesn't there have to be something more still going on here? And I'm hoping there is. They're not pulling it off narratively, but unless there is something more going on here, then this has become incredibly stupid.
I don't know that there's more going on, AJ. Like, it's like, at least by the end of episode 6 and throughout episode 7, you know, everything leading up to this point was Ethan against the town. And while Ethan seems to buy the reality that he's been sold by Pilcher, he's not really against them in terms of, he's no longer trying to escape. He may be trying to, you know, change some, you know, bylaws, which is not going to be, and it's like, okay, we're not going to have any more reckonings. Maybe let's approach it this way. That's not going to be exciting TV either. So it seems like the main conflict now is, you know, those who do not know trying to escape the town versus those who do know the truth. Let's start getting to some of like how that trail of breadcrumbs is initially being laid down in episode 6. We see, you know, I think this is where we're kind of introduced to Ted the delivery guy, because he goes to the toy store to drop off a package, and they go into the back room of the toy store, and which we learned is not bugged, that they've somehow managed to keep that diffused from surveillance. And Peter McCall, the former realtor, has some special package that is part of some larger underground movement. And this is where this is where in episode 6 we're first really kind of introduced to some of the insurgency that's going on.
Yeah, we kind of get immersed into the world of the fifth column, or whatever you want to call it, where the toy maker is not just a toy maker, but he's also got a little side habit there of bomb building, that he's working on that with Ted, who's helping them out with deliveries. And you kind of get the sense that this, you know, the realtor with our graffiti master, the tagger in town, was also you know, hinting at that there was something explosive was coming. And unfortunately for them, or perhaps fortunately down the line, Ethan's wife gets unexpectedly thrust in the middle of this, because now she's sitting in his old job there at the realtor.
Yeah, it's almost like Peter was like the one person you wouldn't want on the insurgency. Like, he's like basically, it sounds like he went rogue a little bit, and he was, you know, spray painting messages around the town that kind of got him caught. But that doesn't seem like it was enough to tip off the very specific information Filter had about there being explosives and the wall being taken down. Still not sure where he got that info, but at the same time, why threaten a reckoning upon Peter McCall as opposed to keeping him and interrogating about the other people that are in this terrorist cell, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, and throw into the mix there, I still can't quite understand the motivations of Teresa's boss at the realtors.
Yeah.
He's acting as if he knows more about what's going on, and that he's like, look, you know, I know you've been looking at that little map there for this mysterious plot 33, which somehow is the key to everything, but don't look into it anymore, because they're watching and they're listening, and just don't poke your nose in and don't stir up trouble. It's like he could be, you know, sent there to keep an eye on her, you know, in the scheme of things. Is he working with Pilcher? Does he know? Does he not know? Is he just kooky nutters? I mean, it's hard to really know what side he's on. And at the beginning 5 episodes, when it was like, you know, Ethan versus the town, not knowing who in the town knows versus who doesn't and who's in on it works. Now Ethan's pretty much been told, hey, nobody in the town knows.
Yeah, it's like, you know Pam is in on it. You suspect Megan is in on it. Well, you know Megan is in on it.
And that's it.
And I think that's it. I don't know to what extent the mayor, Megan's husband, is. But I had the same question in my notes. It's like, how much does Bill know? Or Big Bill, the boss. And because like, there's even the scene where, you know, when Ted stops. So there's the part where, you know, Teresa, or where Kate basically gets Teresa out of the realtor's office. So that at first, I wasn't quite sure why, but it's obviously now later. So Ted can go in there, the delivery guy, and abscond with the package that Peter had laying around there. But when he goes in, you know, you see Bill, you know, questioning Ted about, you know, you've been awfully close to that, you know, Kate Ballinger, and what's up with that? It almost seems like, is he interrogating him on the part of, on behalf of Pilcher, or is he just nosy and teacher's pet? I don't know. It's I'm not sure where Bill stands. And I'm still not sure.
Exactly. And there's nothing there to grasp onto. It's like a mystery without reason. You know, it's just like, oh, we need an antagonist, and so we'll just make him antagonistic, even though we don't really know if he has any power at all. It's very confusing. You know, he doesn't stop anything either. I mean, he as nosy and as nuisance as he is, it's like, oh, I see you've been hanging out with her. Oh, I see. And, you know, at the end of the oh, going to Survivor or confessional mode here. At the end of the day, you know, he just says, okay, goodbye. I'm going home. No, lock up.
Yeah, and you see it, and we can, you know, looking forward a little bit into episode 7. You do see that, you know, he's talking. Well, first of all, I don't know why Teresa keeps bringing up Lot 33. To her boss. Like, it's obvious that he's wants her to stay away from it, so I don't know why she keeps prodding him for it. But we do see that when she's talking to him, he does glance nervously at the camera that's kind of hidden behind this something hanging on the wall. So it almost seems like I'm leaning towards he doesn't know much and just trying to keep everything hunky-dory. But
yeah, I don't know if it could be a case of Stockholm syndrome in that, you know, it's like, look, you know, everything is nice here when we behave. Please, everyone behave. It could be that sort of thing where, you know, the people in the town don't raise questions because the alternative is, you know, a reckoning. We also know that there's so much surveillance in town that eventually they're going to figure out, hey, you know, the five people who suddenly disappeared, or the six people who always are going to this one house at night for meetings, maybe those are the people we should question first. I mean, if we know they have surveillance, they're going to surveil.
I'm surprised that they have been able to get as far as they apparently have with their plot.
I think it comes down to what I said is that Dr. Pilcher and Pam are pretty much the only ones in charge, and they're incompetent. I mean, I think that is what it is in a nutshell. Like, we think of all these cameras, and, you know, I worked in the casino for many years before I became a sports writer. You know, and one of the things that keeps casinos safe from theft to a large degree is the fact that there's this myth that no matter where you go in the casino, there's a camera on you at all times. And if you were to do something, cheat or something, the powers that be will see you. And the fact of the matter is, yes, there are cameras everywhere, but generally speaking, there's only five or six that are active at any given time. Pit boss usually will call up and say, hey, put the camera on because I think there's something suspicious going on. They don't have the manpower to watch everything. So it's more just the threat of surveillance more than the surveillance itself. I get that. However, if you have done the surveillance enough to know there is a terrorist threat and a group building, then you've seen it. You can't unsee it.
And we do see they can go back and look at archive footage. So
yes,
it's a little bit like the computer game SimCity, where you have basically one person controlling this entire town. You can't be everywhere at the same time.
Right. For a little while, I get it. For a little while, you know, they're not monitoring every single conversation. You can get away with a hint here, a hint there. I could even buy a secret meeting once in a while. Sure. Absolutely. You know, the two-man surveillance crew got to sleep, too. But if they know enough to know that there is a plan, then they know who's doing the plan. It's just as simple as that.
Yeah, so we see Ted successfully, and I think it was a nice little move. You get the empty bottom box, walk into the realtor's desk, put the box over the thing you want to take, and then kind of pick it all up as one cohesive unit. actually not a bad plan for getting out of the realtor's office with.
Well, that part was fine. The lame. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean Teresa Burke. I meant Teresa Barco. Yeah, whatever name you came up with. Oh, it's a different Teresa. I'm sorry. Oh, my bad.
Luckily, there's another Teresa in town because that isn't a certainty.
This is very true. Especially, they were very fortunate.
Especially you're talking to the realtor who probably knows where everybody lives in every house.
Exactly. But that's on the other side of town. It would have had a different zip code.
And then we do see at the end of episode 6, Ted does deliver the what looks like it's an explosive device that they're waiting for to Harold Ballinger, who builds it into a more complete bomb in a music box. And then I think the other story route that kind of splits off in the realtor's office is we do finally get to see Henrietta, the receptionist, who is indeed, as we suspected, ticked off that Teresa took the open spot at the realtor's office.
Yes.
but where is she? She kind of brings up some good points when she's talking to Teresa. It's like, where am I going to move to? What job am I going to take? It's not like there's a lot of options for Henrietta at this point.
And it's again, it comes down to that kind of weird, the conceit of the first half of the season was that it was a weird town. It was a town that these people couldn't leave, but that, there was the idea that they could leave was still there. I mean, it's just kind of weird that she's like, well, where am I going to go? Well, maybe I'll go back, in her head, she's thinking, well, maybe I can convince someone to get me out of behind the walls and I'll just go to Seattle and visit my sister. Like, that's kind of what I see in her thought process. Either she knows she's leaving, she can leave, or she knows she can't leave. And they're trying to play it both ways still. And it just doesn't work for me now that we know what we know.
Yeah, I really think the only reason Henrietta existed was to drop. Basically, she's the one that tells Teresa that Peter thought that plot 33 was a way out, but looking into it got him killed. Okay, I'm gonna leave now. And it really, like, she only served to be that. It reminds me of, like, I've run several murder mystery parties, and there's certain conversation lines that take place only to drop a particular clue. And that's what it seemed like Henrietta's role was to get Teresa. From a story perspective, to get Teresa on the trail of plot 33 in the town. And then that's where we talked a little bit earlier, but that's where she finds the surveyor's map of the town, and she swings by plot 33, and it just looks like an abandoned lot. And she kind of just leaves it for then until we get to episode 7. But maybe this might be the biggest mystery, actually, that's going on right now is, what is the deal with plot 33? Why is it there?
To me, plot 33 is, it's the thing at the end of episode 10. It's like this is okay up to episode 5. Now we made this right turn. It's like, all right, plot 33. When we figure that out, show over. Yeah. I think that's kind of like it's almost like the Twin Peaks thing where, like, okay, we know who killed Laura Palmer. Now what do we do for the rest of season 2? Like, okay, let's figure something out here. We got it now. Win the world. Okay, good. So I think it's just plot 33 is like, now that we solved every other mystery, we still need some sort of mystery hanging out there. The only bad thing is that it's not Ethan's mystery to solve, it's Teresa's, and I don't really know that I buy her ability to solve it without all of surveillance and all of this world just losing whatever logic is left.
I could see it going one of two ways in terms of, like, I could see there being two endings filmed, and in one, plot 33 holds a solution, a wrap up to a big storyline that gets served up in the last few episodes. Or if it turns out the series did so spectacularly well that they're going to turn it into a second season, that there's something in addition that they find there that kicks off a series of new potential episodes.
But, oh no. Plot 33 is a tunnel that lets you out of the dome.
It's the hatch. It is the hatch.
Yeah, but the hatch was well thought out, and again, after a full season, it wasn't something that you could hold the mystery of, hey, we discovered the hatch, and there's something in the hatch, and we're not going to tell you. And that was still somehow satisfying in many ways. This is just like, why do they even call it Plot 33? Why didn't they just call it Deus Ex Machina in Waiting? It strikes me as that. But, well, all right, you know, hey, maybe they'll prove me wrong.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a mix of that and Chekhov's plot. If you introduce the Plot 33 in Episode 6, it must be resolved by Episode 8. And I don't think we're going to see that. I mean, that's kind of like a wrap-up of all the major things, at least in Episode 6. I mean, to kind of put a bow on the whole, you know, Plot 33 thing, and it gets wrapped up rather succinctly, or at least there's a brief mention of it in Episode 7. We do see Teresa walking past it again in Episode 7. This time she goes to explore it, and apparently the best way that I could describe it is it seems like it's just like a big metal ceiling to something that's lightly covered with dead grass, and she gets like a piece of iron rebar and just starts kind of poking at the ground, and she's indeed hitting metal. And that's really all we learned further about Plot 33 in this two episode arc.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, you know, I have a neighbor here in the suburbs where I live, and he wanted to pave over some of his lawn to extend his driveway a little bit, and he discovered that he couldn't do it because the gas and electric lines just happened to run underneath the patch that he wanted to expand to. And if he had expanded onto over this area, then anytime there was a gas or electrical problem, they would have to break up his driveway and dig underneath. So you can't build over it. So to me, the fact that there's a metal structure there, like, this is a supply line. Yeah. So, you know, we can't build over this. We need easy access for an emergency to get into the sewer system or something. Like, that would make sense to me. Just in terms of town planning, even, that would make sense to me. There doesn't have to be a bigger mystery to this.
Yeah.
Certainly not where I'd be like Teresa banging on it with a stick. Again, no surveillance here. You know, she walks into the one locked lot area, like, oh, let me ding, 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 ding. Oh, I've been told not to look here. Ding, 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 ding. I wonder, like, in broad daylight, in the middle of the day. Like, this makes no sense. But, you know, the fact that she found a metal thing, like, yeah. And okay. It doesn't have to be anything nefarious there. I mean, it's a TV show. We think they're putting importance to this. It would be a disappointment if there wasn't anything important there, because otherwise, why spend all this time on it? But in the real world, if you were this character, it'd be like, okay.
Yeah, it's like growing up in, you know, in Michigan, it could be a septic tank, it could be a well. I mean, it could be any number of things. But given that it's Wayward Pines, we are immediately, you know, suspicious of it. We'll see where that goes, because I have a feeling we have not seen the last of Plot 33. We've seen the last of it in Episode 7.
Right. And the thing with Episode 7, and this is kind of ties into this, is that the story of Episode 7 is that Ethan agrees to come back into the town, and he promises Dr. Pilcher, all right, I won't tell anybody. we all know how well that promise is going to go. But, you know, he said, I'm not going to tell anybody, but he can't help himself, and he's at least going to tell Teresa.
Yeah.
What's going on. And she will not believe him. She thinks that he has been brainwashed, or that they did something to him. That's her initial gut reaction, is, you know, her husband, who she doesn't trust because of the affairs he's had. So I'm sure that, you know, I can buy that she doesn't necessarily trust all his stories. But immediately she says, ah, he's been brainwashed. This is not the future. He's crazy. He's working for them. They got to him. He's my enemy. I mean, that's immediately where she goes to. Yet she's so willing to take on this Plot 33. Oh, there's a conspiracy going on here. So on the one hand, the left hand, oh, there couldn't possibly be a conspiracy going on, and this is really the future. On the other hand, oh, yeah, there's got to be a secret thing underneath here that that I have to investigate further. It's really a bizarre dichotomy that she's holding in her brain right now.
In defense of Teresa, Ethan did not do the best job of breaking the news to her. I mean,
granted,
like, I'm like, no, sit her down, like, tell her the entire story of, like, you know, I went, like, start with the mountain climbing. And I can't remember how much of it was handled in a breakaway, or it seems like we just see a lot of Ethan standing there, staring off into the distance, not making eye contact with his wife as he goes to explain what's going on. But yeah, he's not sitting down with her in a rational manner to kind of tell the story. Well, here's what happened, and Pilcher told me this, and then he took me in here and told me this, and here's what we think is going on. And you know, feel free to show a little skepticism, but Teresa, I think that this might be right. Let's explore this further together.
Exactly. And on top of this, here's this is pretty much that was the exchange. That was the scene where I like really felt all my confidence in the show slipping away. Two things here. Either he's hemming and hawing because he thinks they're listening, which I would get. But we see later on in this episode that I deactivated all the listening devices. Don't worry. So why didn't you just do that first? Or at least, you know, make some, they're listening. Hey, hang on. Give me a second. And then deactivate them, because we can see he knows how to deactivate the devices. Or B, he knows his son knows. It would be so simple for him to go, listen.
Family meeting.
Here, Teresa, I'm telling you this story, Teresa. He knows. He's not supposed to tell us, but I'm now going to watch his reaction, and we'll know that he knows that I know that he knows, okay? Just the fact that that was not the course of action there. And like you said, yes, the script calls for him not to come out and spell it out, because otherwise the show'd be over.
I was expecting him to fully spell it. I didn't necessarily think that the show would be over if he told her. I thought he was just bad at it. Like, I think he wanted her to know, and I think he wanted to tell her. But, like, he was, like, I don't know how, you know, we wouldn't want him in charge of telling Group B the truth. You know, or it would go over as successful as Pilcher telling Group A. They need somebody here as a professional communicator to help soften the blow of things. And
Yes, but wouldn't the whole situation? I mean, granted that Pilcher doesn't want to tell people, I get that. So it's him versus Pilcher. So I get that. But couldn't he just say, "Look, I get that," but you know, I'm going to be at this home with my wife. My son already knows. It's like, let me take my wife on a helicopter ride.
Yeah.
Just let me show her. We'll put her back in. We'll monitor her. I'm willing to put my wife up as the sacrificial lamb here in case things go nuts. We'll put a close eye on her. But if she can handle it, then we'll take, you know, some other people. I know Kate. I trust Kate. We'll take her in the helicopter. We'll, you know, slowly we'll show people, and we'll do it slowly.
I'm wondering how he did it the first time. Like, gathered people in the town square, just announced it over the loudspeakers. Like, let's have this, a small pilot test amongst a small group of people. But to your point, it's like, if I want to do my job effectively, I can't be living two lives, like my life knowing everything and having to pretend I don't know anything with my wife. I was good through episode six. I was fine through episode six. It's just that episode seven is where I was left hanging a lot, and we'll talk about many of those points. The next day, he goes to drive the family to work into school, and then he sees that the car radio is blinking 12 o'clock. I know VCRs did that, for those of you who remember VCRs. But this is suspicious to him. He sends Ben and Teresa, you know, go ahead and walk to school. It's a nice day. Walk to work. And he finds what I guess is a pipe bomb.
Yeah. Ooh. A little too on the nose. It's a little too perfect cop for me.
Yeah.
That situation. But okay. I mean, you know, what's the alternative? Like, he starts the car, it blows up, and the show's over. So, you know, I get it. He's got to show that he does have the bona fides to do this job, I guess. Because I at this point, I'm feeling like Ethan's one of the worst law enforcement agents of all time. And he is able to kind of, like, steer them off and get his family out of harm's way. You know, to me, it's trying to reemphasize the fact that he'll do anything to protect his family. I don't necessarily think they follow through with this theme enough throughout the course of the show, but I get it.
I think that also raises another interesting point in terms of does the skill set of a field agent translate to being the sheriff of a community? And I think we're seeing no.
Yeah, very, very true. Very true.
Let's look at the job description, and you know, the fact that he deals with the fact that he's licensed to carry a gun is really maybe the only point of overlap between the two positions. But yeah, he takes the bomb into the sheriff's office and just starts dismantling it. And good luck to him with that one. But he looks in the files and pulls out Franklin Dobbs, and highlighted in the folder for Franklin Dobbs was that his former occupation. Well, currently he's apparently the clockmaker in town. But his former life, he was an explosives and demolitions engineer, and that was highlighted. And I guess my question here was, I didn't, and I could be wrong, I didn't remember Dobbs' name coming up before, and the way that I walked away from this, meaning that Ethan must have seen this file earlier and highlighted things that he found interesting, and so maybe he just knew to go, like, explosives in my car, I remember having gone through the files, and this one guy was an explosive engineer. Is that what you took from this, or how did he know to find the DOPS file?
Yeah, I don't. I would think that maybe, you know, we didn't spend a lot of time with these files in you know, the former sheriff's secret, should have been hiding ice cream in their hiding place. I think maybe there were just like a certain set of, hey, these are people to keep an eye on in case kind of section. I don't think it was the entire town. I think it was, these are the ones that we definitely want to keep an eye on. Maybe he had gone through them because he was such a paranoid person when he first got there into the position. Maybe he has studied them all. I'm like, you know, I do think I've seen this. We didn't have to see it. I was willing to give them that.
Okay.
There's a lot coming up that I won't, but, you know, for example, just, you know, thinking out loud here, if you are the doctor and thinking I'm going to repopulate this town with people that I need to, you know, be calm and not go insane and blow the whole thing up, why do you wake up an explosives expert?
Well, I'm wondering, like, if he was needed at any point for the building of the wall, like in terms of, like, there's a problematic outcropping that we need to take care of because it's in the way of where the wall wants to. I'm more concerned about, you know, we talked about this, I think maybe one of the first times that we recorded, was if all these people were handpicked, how did that receptionist at the sheriff's office get handpicked?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we need peons and I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Between her and the hotel guy, I'm like, oh, okay, maybe we just want nice, normal people here, quote unquote.
Yeah, we need somebody with a background in hotel and restaurant management. But he, yeah, you know, he's looking through the files, and then Pam shows up, we're all ready to help, you know, I can be a really good friend, I'll do anything for my brothers, starts to verge on the creepy a little bit. Although I did like in episode 6, how in one of the flashback scenes, you know, she's, you know, Pam's trying to build her brother up and like, you know, we can do this. You know, no one believes you, but we can still make a difference. He's like, yeah, me and my recovering drug addict sister are going to take on the world. I'm like, that's kind of a dick thing to say, just to be completely honest with you, Pilcher.
Yeah, well, you know, their relationship is complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. But he basically follows up with Dobbs and, you know, we kind of continue down the path of suspect to suspect. He meets with Franklin Dobbs at the bar that's not the beer garden. Because there's three drinking establishments at that. There's the beer garden, there's the non-beer garden bar, and then there's the coffee shop. So Ethan and Franklin meet at the non-beer garden bar. He says he wants to get all to know all the shopkeepers on Main Street as the new town sheriff. And wants to know talk to him about gophers because he knows he worked in explosives demolition. And Franklin kind of freezes up and says, sorry, I can't help you. And just kind of, you know, takes off. He has to get back to the clock shop. I don't know what Ethan was trying to get from him, but he was either completely inept at getting at it subtly or completely unwilling to get at it directly. But I'm not sure what was up with the whole Ethan Franklin meeting at the beer garden and what Ethan hopes to get out of it.
Well, I think he was trying to do the standard trope of, hey, you know, let's say something and then we'll tail him and see where he goes or see who he calls immediately, kind of thing. I know this guy's probably not the brains behind the operation since he's the explosives guy, so let's see who he turns to when he thinks that I'm on to him. I could see that as his tactic there. It's a simple time-honored tradition for lawmen to use this tactic, and you know, our good friend Ethan is nothing if not time-honored and simple.
Well, and you know, Franklin says he has to get back to the shop, but he doesn't, you know, he leaves the bar and immediately goes to the coffee shop where he's sitting down with Harold Ballinger. And we just see, you know, Ethan walks up the window, sees them chatting, and goes in and kind of busts up the conversation. Franklin runs past him, and he, you know, basically sits down with Harold and takes him in. They talk about he probably brings up the bomb that was in the truck, and Harold tries to run and gets tackled by Ethan. And so we finally have a member of the insurgency, apparently.
Yeah, it's, what was he thinking? What was he thinking running away?
Harold?
I mean, he knows he can't go anywhere, right?
Yeah.
Is that the whole point of him being an insurgent in the first place?
Yeah.
It's just, that's where like the script writing just kind of like, you know, started to drift for me. It's like, that's not a normal reaction. I mean, I get fight or flight response, but... You know,
at least with Franklin, I like your point. I didn't put this together, but I think you're the good point. Is like, if he's the explosive expert, he's probably not the person in charge. So he's going to track down the person in charge. And I think it was a surprise to Ethan that Franklin Dobbs went to speak with Harold. And so I think that kind of seeing them talk there clicked everything together in his mind. And the fact that Harold, I think, seemed fearful and seemed unwilling to speak, and the fact that he's married to Kate, he put two and two and two together, and was like, okay, you know, you say that you didn't know anything about a bomb, but then you said you put the bomb in my truck. I'm really not buying it, but you know what? I'm gonna let you go. Just give this note to Kate, and I need to speak to Kate.
Yeah, and I think that was also, I mean, Reed Diamond is a good actor, so so is Ian Tracy, who plays Franklin. I mean, they're phenomenal actors. I love them in everything they've ever done, but to me, it's the script that's letting them down here. It's like, he turns on a dime there, and it's so obvious that he's just trying to protect his wife. So, he's like, no, I did it all. No one else. It was me. Certainly wasn't Kate, who you know I'm married to. And it was so obvious a turn that it was just like, well, of course Ethan's going to see that and now try and get Kate.
Yeah, and I think the moment you see Harold, I think you immediately go to Kate, because I don't know if he has a file on Harold or not, but the fact that you know that Kate, there's an insurgency group, that Kate has this former, you know, former agent in her as a part of her background, it's, I think the moment that he saw, that Ethan saw Harold, he figured that Kate was probably, you know, in charge of everything here. But to your point earlier, she stops by his house, and he tells her that he's disabled all their surveillance, but she also has no idea who put the bomb in his truck. And it seems like this, just like Peter going rogue and spray painting around the town, I think you get the sense that that Harold and even Franklin and Kate suspect that somebody else is going rogue and trying to take out him as sheriff. And so, but you know, Ethan figures out that if Kate didn't put the bomb in the truck, he's pretty sure that A, you're the leader, and B, you can figure out who can. And she pretty much cops to it. She says, yeah, it's this is what's kept me sane.
which again, is a bizarre thing for her to trust him so completely there. Like, yes, because Ethan, I knew, would, of course, you know, believe me when I said, you know, and I'll trust him enough to, you know, he called me here. He could have just arrested me or turned me into the powers that be, but you know, he's hearing me out. And so of course I'll be open to him, and I'll say, yeah, you know, because I've been here for 12 years. I've gone crazy. And this group and trying to fight back, you know, that's all I've got. And so, you know, in the next moment, when he tries to clue her into what he's learned.
Yeah, he's this is where he again drops the ball in terms of not telling people the secret. But yeah, it kind of comes out where she's like, why would I stop trying to escape this prison? And it's like, well, okay, I got some home truths for you. And she's just completely not buying this. Like, she thinks that he's now working for whoever's behind this. She thinks that he's brainwashed. And he gives her until tomorrow morning to hand over all the explosives. This will get swept under the rug.
Exactly. It just makes no sense that like I said, she was so willing to trust him with this. Yes, I am the leader, and I'm confessing, and he doesn't turn her in, and he gives her time to fix things and everything. But at the same time, he's clearly insane and working for them, even though he just proved to me he wasn't really working for them. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, I can see how, again, she's been there for 12 years. Maybe she just thinks this is all some like bizarre attempt to just make her go insane. So from her standpoint, I can kind of get it. I can kind of see why she might not trust him. Yeah. It's a little different than with Teresa, where I'm just like, dude, Teresa, come on.
Yeah, well, it's just like, fast forwarding a little bit. I mean, we do hear, Kate says to Harold that we have to escalate things. And after a brief fertility council appointment at the hospital, Kate runs into Teresa and they have that heart to heart and they talk about, are they kind of now on the same page that they, but are they both fearful that somebody has gotten to Ethan and brainwashed him? Is that kind of how we're meant to kind of take that conversation?
Well, yes, that is how we're supposed to take that conversation. And they're finding common ground in the fact that they both clearly care about Ethan, and they both clearly understand that they're the only two people who know him well enough to know that he's not acting in a way that they're familiar with.
Right.
Maybe he's someone who will cheat on his wife, but he's not someone who would be acting the way he's acting now and talking crazy without some sort of prodding from someone else. So yeah, I think they're on the same page there, which is why the next time we see Teresa talking to Ethan, that made no sense to me. I don't know if we want to get there just yet.
Jump right there.
So she goes and talks to Ethan and says, I spoke with Kate. And it sounded to me like she was saying goodbye for reals. Not like see you later, but like she was planning something and plotting something. Like if she... I think she was on the same page. She thinks her husband's cuckoo nutters and being brainwashed. She talks to someone who supports her fears. Does she hate Kate that much that if Kate agrees with her, she's going to now disagree with her?
I don't know, but then Ethan also is like, so you both think I made this up? You think this is all in my head? And he starts getting defensive.
Right. But she turns on a dime again because it serves the plot and says, no, I think she's plotting some tonight. So why don't you check into that since you're the sheriff at all?
Oh, I shouldn't have given her until tomorrow. Stupid. The one interesting thing that was disclosed during this whole kind of this sequence that we were discussing is that Kate does tell Teresa that when she got into town, she called a secure line back to headquarters, and Agent Hassler picked up and told her that she's found herself in the middle of a government experiment. She has to lay low, and she'd be severely tested, possibly by another agent. And there's like a small part of me that's wondering, is this meant to give us as viewers pause as to what could possibly be going on to Wayward Pines? Or is this just us learning what Kate's been fed and we are supposed to continue to believe that we know what's really going on?
I think that the call that she made is exactly in there, or at least telling us about the call she made to Hassler, and that, a government agent's going to test you later on. I think that's totally in there to kind of give us that same sense of doubt we had at the beginning of the series. You know, when the show started, Ethan was having hallucinations, and so we weren't necessarily supposed to take everything at face value, and I think that was the thing that kept us from guessing what the big reveal was in 5. Not that we were going to guess that, but it gave us some sort of like, well, even now, could this all still be in his head? Sure. Conceivably could be. It'd be lame at this point, but yeah, it could still be in his head. So could she have been told that? Yes. Does that mean it is a government experiment? probably not. Again, I'd be disappointed if that were the case at this point. I think we have to accept that reality of the truth as being the truth going forward. But it does explain her state of mind, and at least it gives us some reason to think that maybe we shouldn't take everything at face value that Ethan knows as well. Although at this point, I really hope we should.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I have no doubt that Kate did make that call, and I guess where I was stuck wondering is, wait, so is this all actually a government experiment? And I'm really hoping that we're not entering the final three episodes, like, for the last. If that is the case, then that means that episodes 5, 6, and 7 were all lies, and we could have actually just gone with 8, 9, and 10 as episodes 5, 6, and 7.
Right.
So
right.
I'm hoping it is 4,028, AJ.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, we did see in a flashback scene, which, well, we'll call them flashbacks under the assumption that it is 4,028. So, but we saw basically that Dr. Pilcher was in the real world talking to Hassler and saying everything's taken care of. And I can imagine Hassler saying, look, I've helped you out. I got you Ethan, and, you know, his wife and kid are making trouble. You got to take care of them, too. And take me along because I'm on board. So maybe he thought him out, and, you know, when 12 years ago they thought him out to kind of keep Kate under control with that phone call. He could take the phone call in the call center and just say, no, you're cool. Everything's all right.
Yeah. Well, before we get to kind of the final stages of the explosive plan of episode 7, let's rewind a little bit and look at what's been going on in the school system of Wayward Pines. Rewinding slightly, you know, Teresa, you know, after the bomb is discovered by Ethan in the car, Teresa does walk into school and is kind of, you know, Amy and, you know, Megan Fisher meet them out front, and Megan has Amy take Ben to pick up a biology textbook, and pretty much body blocks Teresa from entering the school. It's like, is there a tour I can go on? Are there parent-teacher conferences? No, apparently not.
Yeah, they haven't been here for a long time by any means, but I mean, haven't we already established this? The kids go to the school, you don't, know you can't come in, just stay out of it, you know? I think we've established this already, and I don't know. She's already suspicious, Teresa. She's already been snooping around the town. Does she really need to be snooping around somewhere else as well? We kind of just know what's going on inside, that it's a little kooky. Finally, the show decides, though, to show and not tell a little bit this episode by taking us to said biology class. And wow, I don't remember biology classes being that uncomfortable.
Oh, boy. Lots of awkward analogies from Mrs. Fisher regarding page 17 in the biology textbook. And yeah, procreation is job one at Wayward Pines. And I don't know which is more awkward. Just hearing the teacher talk about it, or having, like, Ben, Amy, could you come to the front of the room, please? Like, where is this going?
Yeah, thankfully this is still on Fox and not HBO, because I think it could have gone somewhere a little bit closer to the dark place where your gut was telling you it might go. She just used them up there as fully clothed models for the demonstration, but she did use lots of colorful language in terms of hinting that the male and female form are so well suited to fitting into each other perfectly. No.
Like, teacher, counselor, and apparently matchmaker, getting all sorts of weird. Even like after the class, she's talking to Amy in a conversation that's probably not sanctioned by most schools. Like, you and Ben look so nice together. And as a teacher, it is so fulfilling when assignments turns into something more. I'm like, no.
Yeah, I don't recall that your homework was to actually procreate, but I guess it was. That was the subtext there. The first generation needs to beget the second generation as quickly as possible. Let's get cracking, girls. Seduce those boys.
we find out Amy wants to take Ben out that night and, you know, to achieve a new level of intimacy. It kind of hit me, there's really no way to escape a stage 5 clinger in Wayward Pines. You're kind of stuck there. And I think, you know, Megan kind of thoughtfully points out that, you know what, Amy, you might be his first real girlfriend.
Yeah, big shocker there. I can't really tell by reading the emotion on his face, because no one can tell anything from reading the emotion on his face.
Yeah. So after school, she does approach him and says, you know, there's a really sweet spot I want to show you in the woods, a sweet spot in the woods that I want to show you. I have a plan. And she kind of eyeballs the delivery truck. I'm like, okay, these are the kind of things are coming together now. And did you see what was coming, so to speak, in terms of she has a plan that involves the delivery truck. We know that Ted, the delivery guy, is involved in the explosives plan. This is where things started to, like, I kind of see where we're going to get some people in trouble they shouldn't be in.
I saw this coming from about the year 2273. Yeah, this was so telegraphed. And okay, let's wheels are in motion. Let's just get to it already. I mean, it just the whole thing is that we see the truck and we know that he's going to sneak out and try and meet her on this illicit rendezvous. And of course, he does sneak out and. I mean, I don't know how he was planning on sneaking back in through that circuitous route that he has to take, but okay, whatever. Well, you know, he sneaks out, he meets her, and they're going to hitch a ride on the delivery truck, which they know stops at this spot every night at 10 because they follow the route perfectly, and she knows. And of course, at this one stop, it's the only stop in the world that he decides not to check to make sure his door is locked at the tail end of it.
Yeah.
Then we kind of TV.
We kind of get into the tail end of the, and this is where things kind of went off the rails for me a little bit, in terms of the everything just suddenly switched to this breakneck pace of stuff happening. I just suddenly was confused by the pacing of it. But so step one, Harold and Ted are meeting at the beer garden, and Harold surreptitiously delivers the music box bomb to Ted. Step two, Ted puts said bomb in delivery truck.
Yes, and you know, when you've got a powerful bomb that's going to blow up the fence, you want to leave it in a paper bag just sitting free in the back of a truck that you're going to drive at you know, speeds of, that's certainly not going to cost us a jostle at all. Okay, sure. Well, all right, we'll go with it.
Let's not secure it down in any way.
Yeah.
Wrap it in some of the padding that you get from U-Haul.
No, just leave it sitting right there out on the edge where it might even fall out if you're not careful.
And as we predicted, stage three, the youngins, they hop in the back of the truck. I, for some reason, thought she was going to steal the truck. But apparently the truck theft is not required.
Oh, no. I didn't think they were going to steal the truck. I fully took her at her uncreative word that when she said hitch a ride, that she meant hitch a ride.
Yes. Then we see Ethan, like, we knew that things were going to escalate from Kate's perspective. We see Ethan running through the woods. He's in communications with the surveillance team. He says, like, there's a blind spot near zone 41, and that must be where they're at. So he gets there just as Kate and Franklin and others are putting a bomb-like device on the wall with a... They say, no, we have to do this quickly. The guards circle around back in 10 minutes. But yet they set the timer for 10 minutes. So I don't know, were they planning on taking out the guards?
Well, you know, maybe the guards wouldn't be able to notice, wouldn't notice in time. They divert them. I don't know.
But Ethan gets there and gets them to, you know, Franklin disarms the bomb. He has them taken down at gunpoint. He even kind of, you know, holds Kate at gunpoint to convince Franklin to disarm the bomb. And he gathers everybody, but he kind of just leaves the bomb up at the top of the wall. That was my favorite part of this entire scene. That diffused bomb is, or I don't know if it's diffused, the timer is off. It's still at the wall.
Yeah, well, the I'm sure we'll forget about that.
Yeah, but he takes them in and locks everybody up, and that's when Ethan kind of notices that Harold is not here.
Yeah, that's when he notices of all the five people he's brought in that he's not there.
Yeah, and puts two and two together again and realizes something else must be going on. So he goes back to the surveillance room. I can't tell if this was at the... Pam was there, so maybe this was at the hospital, like in the slide room, or if this was actually in the bunker. But anyway, this is where the reviewing of footage does come in handy in Wayward Pines. But he asks Pam to help him track down Harold. She sees him transfer, like hand off something to Ted in the beer garden. And, well, where is Ted now? Well, he's... You know, making his route. He's making his rounds. He switches out for a new truck every night by the fence. And you know, cut to Amy in the truck finds the music box and basically arms the bomb. I'm thinking.
Yeah, exactly. By playing the song again. The not the most brilliant timer, but whatever.
Yeah, and proceeds to make out with Ben. Because nothing sexier than that music box music. And,
well, it's not like they have the radio. I mean, you know, we haven't seen any iPads or you know, anything like that. I know that certainly the broadcasts from MTV in New York have ceased over the past 2,000 years. So.
Yeah, is there a town radio station? Because, you know, they do have radios in the car.
Well, that would take us way too close to Under the Dome territory. So no. We don't want to be seen as Under the Dome. No radio station, please.
That's true. Forget. I didn't make it past season one on that, but I forget there was a radio station. And so Ethan tries to chase down the delivery truck, and some jokers push the dumpster into the middle of the road that he just plows head into. His car gets taken out. He resumes the chase on foot, and you know the truck stops at a core crosswalk, and as Ethan thinks he's about to catch up to it, it explodes.
Yeah.
And Amy and Ben somehow end up on the outside of the truck. I'm so confused, AJ.
Okay, so...
Did they get out here, or...?
Well, the back door of the truck seemed to have been blown a little bit. And there was a somewhat of a hole on the side of the truck.
Yeah.
Which I assume we were supposed to assume that they were blown out through the side. And because there was like this small little cardboard pile of like wood or some packages there in between, it was enough of a buffer so they didn't die instantly. She's okay. She's a little bloodied and covered in soot, but she's conscious and at least upright. Ben... I mean, I couldn't tell any difference in his acting from the rest of the series, but apparently he was unconscious. I mean, that was news to me. I just thought he was just acting and just not saying anything like usual, showing no emotion. But yeah, he's unconscious and on the floor. And all I can think of, this bomb couldn't blow up two children right next to it. It was going to blow up the fence.
But yeah, the two issues I had is issue one. He found the two of them were outside the truck, right?
Yes.
So, okay, unless they, like, got out of the truck, which Ethan would have seen them getting out of the truck.
No, they did not get out of the truck. They were thrown free of the truck by the blast.
Let's talk about the power of the bomb. The bomb was powerful enough to blow a hole in the side of the truck.
Yes.
But to gently, safely, and in one piece, launch them out of the truck as well. That's if it was powerful enough to blow out the side of the truck, it would have blown out the side of them too. Unless like she dragged him out of the hole and laid him there.
But even so, then it was not strong enough to bust through the small package thing that was separating them from the bomb in the first place.
Yeah, it's. So how they ended up out there and in one piece, like he may be dead, whatever. But how there should be limbs missing. Like you don't get thrown from a truck in that manner. Anyway.
Or conversely, the bomb just wasn't strong enough to blow up the fence in the first place, in which case this is the worst bunch of insurrectionists I've ever seen.
That was my second. Yeah, my second issue with the power of the bomb was the cab of the truck seemed relatively like Ted seems probably fine.
Well, yeah, of course he's gonna walk. He's probably gonna pull a gun on Ethan, and there'll be a gunfight at the start of the next episode. For all I know,
did something happen back there, guys? What was that? Did my backfire?
No, it's cool, yo. It's cool.
So yeah,
I mean, I would be surprised if he just drives off unaware anything happened.
Exactly. The next scene, Grandma leaves the crosswalk, and he just pulls ahead whistling. That would be hilarious. That I'm hoping for oblivious Ted. So bomb powerful enough to blow outside of truck and to teleport two young people outside the truck as well, which is a byproduct of the bomb we didn't foresee. But my second issue was, what was this supposed to do at that like 3 foot deep at least concrete barrier that is the wall? Like, unless they're gonna drive it up to the garage door part of the wall and like punch a hole in that, that might be about the thickness of the I don't care if this doesn't make me sound bad. I don't care if Ben is alive or dead. Be completely honest, it's not me one way or another.
Of course not.
Yeah, I'm more concerned about the recruiting process for these insurgents. My abilities must be able to make bomb that gently destroys side of van. The gophers in town have nothing to worry about, apparently, if this is what Franklin can do. And that's kind of where we're left in terms of the big cliffhanger is, will Ben survive or not?
Oh no! Whatever will we do if Ben is not around anymore?
Because, like, you know, we kind of closed out episode 6 wondering, well, what's the conflict? Like, Ethan's now completely on board with the secrets in town. He, like, the biggest issue he has up until a few minutes before the end of episode 6 is, how can I get this crazy doctor and his sister to see that killing people isn't the best way to control? How can I get people on board with what's going on in town? Until the doctor reveals there's an insurgency. There are these people who mean to do harm. So that's the issue for episode 7. I don't know if that's still an issue now, because everybody's in jail. The bomb that was going to destroy the wall, which seems to be the big thing, blew up a moving van. Why would you put it in? Why wouldn't you put the timer on this one and the music box on the other one? Like,
sorry. Look, all I know at this point is that either this is an extremely long con, where in the final scene of episode 10, somehow everyone comes out and says, you know, surprise, like in the game, or you know, even better, you know, Ben is alive and well, and he's sitting on the couch with the second generation, his lovely son and daughter, and says, and that's how I met your mother. Maybe those two endings I might be okay with at this point, and even then not. No, I have no idea where the show thinks it's going. It's lost the plot entirely. It was too clever by half by coming up with this big reveal in episode 5, and I just don't think they had enough time or forethought to come up with something. I can't see it. Now, again, if they pull this off, if they somehow stick a landing on this, I will eat crow. I will eat many, many helpings of crow and proclaim this from the highest mountaintops of how great a plot script and everything that they pulled off me. But right now, what the?
We're seeing this through.
We're not, it's only three more episodes.
It's, but like, who's the villain now? Who's the antagonist?
Well, I'm the antagonist. I'm very antagonized.
Unless it's like a, maybe it's like a 24, a season of 24, where, you know, the big bomb gets disarmed, 5 hours into the day, and then a bigger. But usually, when that happens, like the final moments ticking down the clock of the hour in which that happens, reveal that there was something bigger going on. And right now, the biggest thing seems to be whether or not a character we're not crazy about is going to live or die.
Yeah, in terms of raising the stakes from episode to episode, they clearly don't understand what that means. If they thought that's going to be the biggest cliffhanger that's going to get us coming back for more. I mean, really, there's a big mystery in place. And you tell us in episode 5, oh, here's the answer to the big mystery. And I appreciate that. I thought that was bold, that was brave. I thought they had something on the second half of this series to follow up with that. And now we're 2 episodes in and I haven't seen it. There's 3 episodes left. This episode is called Betrayal. Yeah, that's what I'm feeling, all right. And I have turned into, we're seeing this through, and I'm hate watching this to the end, unless they can somehow pull me back in, but I don't see it.
Yeah, who was betrayed?
Well, let's see. Ethan betrayed Pilcher by telling, but no one believed him, so there wasn't really a betrayal. I guess he betrayed Kate. No, Kate didn't betray anybody. Teresa sort of betrayed her husband by not believing him, but then she did believe him.
Ted kind of betrayed the insurgency by trying to blow up Ethan's car, but it...
No.
I know that's not...
I think we figured it out. I think betrayal was their betrayal on us. That's the only thing that makes sense at this point.
The title of each episode is the emotion you will feel when you walk away from that episode.
Is next week's episode entitled Stick With Us, Please?
Episode 6's title is Mild Intrigue.
Oh, my.
Okay. Well.
Oh, my.
You ready to put a bow on this, AJ?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Well, a pretty ballerina tutu laden bow.
I'm kind of hashtagless on this one. Do you have anything that stuck out in your mind?
Oh yeah, it just came to us in the last few minutes. I'm very antagonized. That's the hashtag, very antagonized, because that's what I'm feeling right now.
So yeah, so you know, if you've made it this far, both with the podcast and with the series of Wayward Pines, why don't you if you're kind of feeling similar to AJ and I, use the hashtag very antagonized. But you know what, if you're loving where this is at, and God bless you, if you are, then use the hashtag very protagonized. mention both of us so we can kind of keep track of if you're feeling very antagonized or feeling very protagonized.
And if you happen to have some, you know, stomach discomfort, so you need of some sort of medication, say, I'm very antacided.
Very antacided. Thank you guys for listening. I think this is, we didn't promise to love the series the entire way through. I think we've been pretty giving to Wayward Pines for the up through episode 5, and I'd say even I was okay through 6, but this is taking a twist, and we'll see where it ends up taking us for the remaining.
We came with the best of intentions. Yes. We came with open minds, and I just think someone has gotten a hold of the writers, directors, and producers of this show and brainwashed them into thinking that this is good.
If you want to keep track of what's going on in the world of Kurt, you can follow me on Twitter at Kurt Clark. And AJ, anything that you want to report on as well that people want to follow you, keep up with what you're doing?
Yeah, you can always find me on Twitter at my name, AJ Mass, at AJ Mass on Twitter. I'm doing my ESPN thing. You can find me on the fantasy baseball page at ESPN.com/fantasy. And of course, if you like mascots and want to read a good book on mascots and the history of mascots, yes, it's hot in here, available on Amazon and wherever books are sold these days.
Sold in lots of places. I'm sure you can find it in lots of places as well. Yeah, and I guess I should put in a plug for the, we are continuing to cover Big Brother UK. We just, this is wrapping up week 8, I believe. They're in the house for another, 10 days or so. But if you want to listen to that, that's over on Reality TV Wrap-Ups. But otherwise, we will be back to cover episodes 8 and 9 in the near future and see where this ride ends up taking us. So again, everybody, thank you for listening, and take care, and we'll be back soon. Bye.